All rise. Oye, oye, oye. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Joseph L. Toto presiding. All who have business before this court draw near and you will be heard. God bless the United States and its Honorable. Please be seated.
Good morning. I'm Judge Toth, and I'm joined in the courtroom by Judge Falvey, and Judge Greenberg is participating virtually via Zoom. We're here today to consider arguments in the case of Robert L. Stinson versus Douglas A. Collins, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 20-8342. Will counsel, beginning with appellant's counsel, please enter your appearance for the record.
I'm Tom Strong for Mr. Stinson, and this is Jen Healy, my co-counsel.
Good morning, Ms. Strong.
Morning, Ryan Harrison and Mark Hamill for the Secretary.
Good morning, Mr. Harrison. And would appellate's counsel like to reserve time for rebuttal?
Reserve 15 minutes.
Okay, great. Thank you. So noted. I've been informed it's both of counsel's first argument at this court, so welcome. One thing, if we're asking questions, don't worry about time. Just, you know, answer the court's questions along we're asking. Otherwise, we'll try to stick to the time if you need extra ask for it, okay? You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Thomas Strong with Veterans Legal Advocacy Group for Mr. Stinson. This case concerns whether Mr. Stinson prevailed under the EJA. There are at least four independent bases for ruling that he prevailed. First, he obtained an enforceable judgment on the merits that by itself, without any agency or analysis needed, established his prevailing party status. And that status is confirmed by the Federal Circuit awarding him costs under the EJA. Second, his status is law of the case because of the cost award. The Federal Circuit's finding as to costs under the EJA binds the court as to fees. Third, the court's remand order predicated on a VA duty to assist error supports the status. Last, the board's concession of the error conceded after he filed his EJA app also supports the status. Despite these bases, the Secretary asserts that Mr. Stinson didn't prevail. But Mr. Stinson legally won his case by securing an enforceable judgment on the merits. A judgment issue.
What is the judgment on the merits?
So the Supreme Court takes a practical approach to the to whether a case has been won on the merits. What you really need in order to win is that you need the court to impose a duty on the defendant. And if you're able to get the court to impose a duty on the defendant, and that duty causes the defendant to modify their behavior for the plaintiff's benefit.
Right, but I mean, a lot of the fee shifting cases are your kind of classic civil litigation. And so, you know, whether a dismissal, right, is a judgment on the merits or some procedural ruling can be kind of a difficult question. I mean, our case law, the way we've always resolved that is basically just a finding of administrative error.
Yeah, and that usually, because the court is used to seeing remand orders, it's used to issuing remand orders, it requires an agency error. But if you go to Davis, Davis talks about the different judicial decrees that a court can produce on a spectrum. And on one hand, there is the gold standard, which is an enforceable judgment on the merits, where the court has actually reviewed the case, reviewed the arguments. That is the highest level of judicial decree that you can have in order to support a prevailing party status. But this court is usually doing remand orders, like, for example, the product of a JMR, where the court never really analyzes the merits of the case. You're going by what the parties have conceded potentially in a JMR. And that is where you need an agency error to support it. A lot of remand orders in other cases, they could be like an interlocutory ruling where it had, or you'll see a lot of, say you have like an injunction, injunctive relief that's being reviewed, and it's the issue is whether or not there's a prospect that they could win, but they're not really analyzing the merits of the case. They're saying, hey, this could happen.
Right, but so I mean, merits, right, and error go hand in hand. I mean, you can't if you can't analyze the merits, there's no way to assess error. I mean, that seemed to be what the underlying, I mean, that's pretty much what the Federal Circuit's whole decision was about. But this court lacks the statutory authority to really dig into the merits at all.
So I don't quite understand. So this court, in the context of on the remand, or are you?
Yeah, I mean, the word on the merits. Sorry, I turned my mic off because there was going to be some reverb. But if they can't hear me, please tell them. I mean, what does on the merits mean? Unless it's some acknowledgement of error, administrative.
So when it's saying on the merits, if you look at Lackey v. Steiny, the new Supreme Court case, it tells you what on the merits means. And it's counterintuitive because it's not even necessarily on the merits. It's just whether the court says we take a practical approach to this. And so under this practical approach, if there's a duty imposed on your adversary, that's what on the merits means. And it's not very clear necessary. It's a little counterintuitive than what I would think of when I'm thinking, hey, this is an argument on the merits.
So, I mean, Robinson, it's hard to be clearer than this. Robinson says, applying the rules set forth in Buchanan, we have held that remand to an administrative agency for their proceedings can provide the requisite relief required to confer prevailing party status only if the remand is predicated either explicitly or implicitly on administrative error. Then it says, we have held that remand is not agency error to not result in failing status. So again, what would be the administrative error in this case?
So when they're saying remand, they're referring to it's a shorthand for referring to remand order. And the remand order requires the agency error. So what our argument is that the fact that we have to make an as far as the remand order goes, as far as that goes, we're saying that the court imposed a duty to assist, and that points back to a duty to assist error. So because they have to develop the record, it points back to a duty to assist error, and that error supports the remand order for purposes of prevailing under the EJA.
Where in this instant decision is that articulated?
So at the very end of the Stinson decision, they remand it back to this court, and it says, at the very end, it says, we're remanding it back for further factual development consistent with this opinion, including whether Mr. Stinson's in-service symptoms support a BPD-CN with service connection. As to Robinson, one point on Robinson is that it was limited to the facts before it. And in Robinson, it even said, we're not going to say that a discretionary remand always cannot be the basis for a prevailing party status determination. So I mean, Robinson is limited, and so it's not.
The fundamental tension seems to come from in the Federal Circuit's Stinson decision here. I mean, I'm just going to read a couple sentences. It says, Mr. Stinson argues that the Veterans Court exceeded its statutory authority when it found facts in the first instance. And so it says, we agree with Mr. Stinson's position. For this reason, vacate and remand. Veterans Court has no statutory authority to make factual findings in the first instance. So, I mean, the statutory authority is the ability, it's the capacity to adjudicate something. It would be even to look as to whether there was a duty to assist error, any type of failure to address error, anything like that, saying we would lack the authority to even adjudicate it. Right? It strikes me that, I mean, the type of, in Robinson, that fact pattern, our courts did a kind of discretionary remand. And, I mean, it seems to me what Stinson's doing is making that Robinson rule kind of mandatory for these types of cases.
I think that we're looking at this now through a lens of like the EJA, but I think that the court, the main thing in front of the court was fact finding. So it's naturally going to be about fact finding in its decision. So the part where it builds the basis for what we're saying, the implied duty to assist error and the imposition of the duty onto the secretary to develop the record at the very beginning of the case, it develops around the failure to develop pre-2011 symptoms. And it talks about that. It talks about that in the footnotes, and it talks about that at length, that you have this veteran who
he had ringworm, he had a rash, he had nosebleeds, he had stuff in service. And then we you know, our assessment was it wasn't really relevant. I mean, traditionally what happens with the failure to address argument is, I mean, the board can't address every fact in the record. I mean, it has finite resources. And so we would naturally review whether something's relevant. What the Federal Circuit seemed to suggest is that basically we can no longer do that. So we would need something like an automatic remand. Once that's not predicated on administrative error, it just becomes sort of like the type of discretionary remand that was in Robinson. But there would be no finding of error because we just simply cannot adjudicate. We lack the statutory authority to adjudicate this class of cases, these types of allegations of error.
I think maybe the most important, what we view as the biggest error in the brief, and I think that it's coming into this discussion now, is that the secretary said in their one of their responses to the argument order that the touchstone of the analysis is agency error. But if you look at all of the EJIA cases and you read through them, you'll frequently see the court say the touchstone of the analysis is the material alteration of the party's legal relationship. That's the touchstone of the analysis. To look at agency error is to get really narrow and in the weeds.
I mean, it may be a good argument, but you have to take that out. I mean, Robinson, there's a lot of, Robinson cited on some cases. So it's not like it sort of came up with this rule that administrative agencies are required to obtain prevailing party status. I mean, there's been a long line of cases.
I think that we're in line with I think we're in line with the Federal Circuit already, because in Motorola, what Judge Dyke was saying in that opinion was that everything that he analyzed was a remand order, but he says at the beginning of it that an enforceable on the merits stands alone. It doesn't mean that. It's because there were these remand orders, and those remand orders need more because they haven't necessarily even had a merits determination or even a hearing. And that's why it requires the agency error for support. In the bigger scheme of things, it's not just an agency error analysis. That's kind of a creature.
So in your case, because I mean, I think prospectively, you know, we get failure to address issues quite good. I mean, someone could basically achieve automatic remand because we obviously can't really adjudicate these. And then there would be automatic EJIA fees. There seems to be kind of a moral hazard built in here. I don't see how, under what you're arguing, first of all, like any failure to assist argument would require remand, and that wouldn't also require EJIA fees automatic.
So I don't think that it. I think that if it's a remand order, if the court issues a remand order, and there's no duty to assist or there's no agency error, and it
says, I mean, what's
what are the
assess error? I mean, our job as a court is to assess error. If we lack statutory authority to do that, and then we're kind of closed for business.
I think that you have the statute of authority to assess for error. It's just if the board hasn't addressed the error and made a finding about it, then the court doesn't have the ability to make a finding in the first instance.
What is jurisdiction?
Jurisdiction is the power to say what the law is.
Exactly. I mean, jurisdiction, like if someone files a criminal case, like an indictment in this court, we lack jurisdiction. It doesn't matter how close the facts are. It doesn't matter. It's simply not. We have no statutory authority to adjudicate the matter. When Stinson's saying we lack statutory authority to review anything the board hasn't discussed, I mean, what would that mean?
So I think that you do have statutory authority, and you've made this in points in other decisions, is that if it's undebatable, you have statutory authority to make that determination.
If it were the lowest quantum of evidence, a scintilla, right? There would still be cases where that would be a close call. We would require some measure of engagement record. That would, I mean, it's different from prejudice, right? I mean, prejudicial error, there's a finding of error. We have under statute, we have a duty to take due account of prejudice. This is a totally different issue. It's a class of cases where the whole issue is there has been no finding, but, you know, we would make some, you know, what we normally did was make a kind of preliminary relevance determination to see if that was error or not, you know, should they have addressed it. If Federal Circuit's now saying you can't do that.
So what we see is that what really led to the error was the initial failure to discuss any to develop the evidence first about the 2011 symptoms. Okay, so that error exists independent of the even before, and but for the that error, there wouldn't be any litigation. So you have the duty to assist error. That translates at the board because they didn't have a basis to discuss the pre-2011 symptoms. So it doesn't discuss the 2011 symptoms. It doesn't make findings about the 2011 symptoms. The court has the now has the symptoms raised. Mr. Stinson didn't have counsel earlier. He now has counsel. Counsel thinks this it's important, raises it to the court. The court then has the ability to say, hey, we're not going to take this. Mr. Stinson still should have raised this.
The statute, so I understand at the end it's basically the rule would be in considering a new argument appeal, the Veterans Court should appropriately review the record and remand to the appropriate body any factual questions open to debate. Right. So the question would be whether they're erroneous. It's just all we know is they're open to debate. And that would be the prevailing party status isn't whether something's open to debate, it's whether there's administrative error.
So I think that that's when there's a remand order, it's the administrative error. The material alteration is really the sine qua non of the analysis. So that's really what it is. So the court's error is really it misses that it's really at its most basic. It's a court ordering the defendant to do something that it didn't have to do for the plaintiff's benefit. That's how you win a case. Is that the court is saying that you have to do something that you don't want to do or that you didn't have to do. And that's the material alteration of the party's legal relationship.
We don't know. I mean, you know, the counsel raises an argument that there was something in the court should have discussed, right? We say, okay, we can't, you know, this seems to be within some zone that we lack jurisdiction to consider as an open debate zone. And so we're just sending it back as if it never happened. Right? I mean, we're just kind of sending it back to where it was, you know, 6 months earlier for them to do.
So in a hypothetical situation where let's say that there was no duty to assist error, let's say that there's no duty reimposition of the duty to assist after this court's determination that it was satisfied. If that does not exist and you just send it back for the board to just give a new decision, that is not a prevailing party. Because there's been no material alteration, there's no guarantees that he's going to win. There's nothing that establishes that there was a material alteration of the party's relationship.
I mean, just the focal point. And normally, I think I'm going to quote from Davis here. It's, you know, we're not concerned about the ultimate outcome of agency proceedings on the underlying merits case. Instead, our focus is on whether agency error was the reason for the Davis remand. Again, you know, it's not, I don't see, you know, anything, it always turns on error, the finding of error by this court.
It typically does. And the court, there's an inertia of that you're typically doing this with remand orders. And so that requires
in our court's history where we've awarded each of these without a finding of administrative error.
I mean, I would look back to before Buchanan, if you go before Buchanan, before Buchanan eliminated basically what are windfall victories, like from new evidence, you know, coming to light or a favorable change in law, anything that's an unearned victory. That's what it. So if you look before that, between when this court established the EJA and that EJA applied in, I believe it's 1994. If you look at those cases, I would expect you to see no agency error, and I would expect you to see a robust discussions of the material alteration of the party's legal relationship, because that standard has preceded all the agency error standard. And the agency error standard came about in order to ensure, and it came out right after Buchanan. So the agency error is a check. It's really a check on an unearned victory. And so that came about as a matter of Buchanan. It doesn't establish the prevailing party status. That's the material alteration of the party's relationship. That's just imposing a duty on your adversary that they don't want to do. And that's what makes you a winner. That's what makes you win a case.
In its simplest form, is your argument that the Federal Circuit's remand, although based in part on judicial error, was also implicitly based on administrative error?
Yes, and that administrative error is related to the duty that it imposed. And that duty that it imposed caused the material alter relationship. It modified the defendant's behavior in a way that benefited Mr. Stinson by requiring the development of factual evidence about his in-service symptoms specifically and generally about pre-2011 symptoms, which involved cancer. He had a prostate cancer and blood abnormalities that suggested leukemia later on. And those weren't discussed and they weren't developed. And so the Federal Circuit made that. And that's what we prayed for in our relief before the Federal Circuit.
And if we agree with you, setting aside the preclusivity argument or estoppel argument, we agree with you on prevailing party. It's just a question of the reasonableness of the fee.
And also substantial justification.
Yeah.
And our position there would be that the VA didn't develop the record for the pre-2011 symptoms, and then its defense of those of that failure was wrong, and it wasn't a substantially justified position. And then its argument at the Federal Circuit that these were just debatable, these were debatable observations, was not substantially justified either. So that's basically our position. Then the fees are reasonable, and so the court should grant Mr. Stinson's EJIA application.
So, counsel, I appreciate it. I missed you well beyond your time with questions. I'm just probably taking further questions. Judge Greenberg, any questions?
Nothing from me at this point. Thank you.
Is there anything else you want to address?
I think if there's anything, I'll look through the notes and I will, and I'll do that on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That's all.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. The EJIA statute's waiver of sovereign immunity is narrow and precise. In the context of administrative appeals, it applies only when a remand is predicated on or necessitated by agency error. That did not happen here. The court should therefore deny prevailing party status for two reasons. First, the Federal Circuit vacated solely because this court made impermissible factual findings, not because of administrative error. Second, the Federal Circuit's award of costs under Rule 39 reflects only limited procedural success. It does not establish prevailing party status for fees and expenses, which requires a fundamentally different showing. With that, I welcome the court's questions.
I have a question. What effect?
What should the court do when we, in instances like this, where we get a failure to address argument, then it appear to kind of call our jurisdiction into question? What court should we take?
So, Your Honor, just to clarify, we're talking about on the merits, right? Not in the EJIA phase.
On the merits, exactly.
Yeah.
A sure merits case where somebody raises, the board should have addressed something in the record that would be called to make a sort of relevance determination.
Yeah, so I think it's clear from the context of this appeal, at least, in the Federal Circuit's discussion, which I think squares with broader precedent, that this court has the discretionary authority to decline to entertain those belated arguments. But if this court does entertain the argument, then the court has to, may entertain it so long as it doesn't require fact-finding or weighing of evidence. That requires that there's no factual issues open to debate. By entertaining the belated argument here, sort of opening that door, exercising the discretion to entertain the argument, and then resolving matters that the Federal Circuit at least found were factual matters open to debate, that's where the
These would be a lot of remands. I mean, we'd be sending a lot of cases back to the board that, usually the Secretary's litigation position is firm, that this isn't relevant, it's pretty hot. Whatever the fact is, and you should affirm on there was no duty to basically address it. I mean, are we even able to kind of hear these types of cases?
Well, I think it would depend. Of course, if the facts are open to debate, but let's say we're in a situation where the parties are in agreement on the facts, that they're, you know, both parties are on the same page as far as that goes, then yes, I think the court would be able to resolve the appeal, you know, entertain the belated argument, because that's sort of where going to the prejudicial error analysis. But so long as the facts aren't open to debate, I think the court could still, you know, resolve the case on that basis. Or alternatively, the court could say, sorry, this should have been raised below. The board didn't have the opportunity to develop this issue, you know, affirm or can find, well, this is a belated argument. Even if we were to entertain it, we would have to resolve some issues. So therefore, remand. So there are other options on the table. But the point is that if the court does open the door, entertain the argument, and recognize, hey, these are issues that we can't resolve without additional fact-finding, or if there are questions of law, then to remand. And the important takeaway is that such remands do not automatically bestow prevailing party status, because they're not always predicated or necessitated by agency error. That is indeed still the touchstone here in the administrative agency context. The case law requires there to be a material change in the party's relationship, but that is marked by whether there is agency error. It has to be the fault of the government. The remand must be predicated on or necessitated by agency error. And without that, even in a discretionary remand context, prevailing party status isn't guaranteed.
Well, let me ask you about some of the language that Mr. Strong quoted from Stinson then. Then you can explain to me why that doesn't constitute a finding of agency error or administrative error.
So the Federal Circuit explained that one of the earlier symptoms are connected to Mr. Stinson's BPDCN is a factual question for the medical experts. His opinions are then weighed by the board. But then they went on and say, no medical expert nor the board explicitly discussed whether Mr. Stinson's in-service symptoms are evidence of an earlier BPDCN start date than 2011. And then in the remand order, they send it back to the court with instructions to remand to the board for further factual development consistent with his opinion, including whether Mr. Stinson's in-service symptoms support a manifestation of BPDCN earlier than 2011. And it seems they're saying that, yes, there was judicial error in part, but there's also administrative error. There's this, you know, you call it failure to comment on favorable evidence. You can call it inadequate exam. You can call it whatever, but it seems to be pointing to implicit administrative error.
Respectfully, Your Honor, we would disagree. So I'll take your question in two parts.
Okay.
So you've highlighted language showing the Federal Circuit discussing what issues were not resolved, and then, of course, the remedy that's provided. So first, with the issues that are not resolved, I think it's clear that that discussion in the Federal Circuit's decision is pointed to identifying what issues this court could not resolve. It's for the purpose of illustrating how this court took one step too far in resolving questions that the Federal Circuit found were open to debate, and thus in resolving those issues on its own, the court committed judicial error, right? So it's not that the Federal Circuit is providing a discussion directed at the merits of the underlying service.
Why is it no different than reasonably raised argument? We get up, court, please come here on appeal, and counsel makes an argument, and the argument is, and the record reasonably raised this. We didn't discuss it, but the record raised it, and we agree. Isn't that administrative error?
It can be, but I would say we're in a different context here because it's a Federal Circuit decision, so they can't reach the underlying merits of the claim.
But they seem to.
I would disagree. I think that it is, again, it's just discussing it in the context of framing this court's error. So at most, the Federal Circuit is reviewing these factual matters relevant only to this court's jurisdiction.
Well, why didn't the remand just say, back to us, just say, you found facts you shouldn't have. Look at the case again, not finding facts.
So this goes to the remedy, Your Honor. And I think that this situation is similar to Robinson. And that sort of illustrates the fact that the Federal Circuit's remand instruction to this court to remand to the board, it simply reflects the fact that remand and vacator was required to allow the board to make factual findings that this court, as an appellate tribunal, could not make in the first instance. There weren't issues that this court could resolve in a remand order. So it just bisects that point and puts it directly to the board. The Federal Circuit recognizes there are facts open to debate. We've already opened the door to exercising the discretionary authority. So we're going to effectuate that sort of Majeed remand and have the board resolve these issues now on remand. That does not amount to a recognition of administrative error. Again, the Federal Circuit's only discussing the record in the context of this court's jurisdiction and then ultimately providing a remedy to resolve the issues that are open to debate. So I don't think that administrative error can be gleaned from the discussion in the Federal Circuit decision in this case. Again, I think that we're in that Robinson wheelhouse where this is, at bottom, a discretionary remand, and that does not automatically confer prevailing party status. Robinson, Davis as well, they provide sort of that reasoning behind that. Why doesn't a remand, a discretionary remand, provide prevailing party status? And there the Federal Circuit noted that simply allowing a claimant to raise an argument for the first instance below, and that was a result that the Federal Circuit characterized as, to the extent it could be prevailing party status, illogical and contrary to fundamental principles of orderly procedure and good administration. Also in Robinson, noting that the remand simply reflects the Veterans Court's discretion to allow a waived argument to proceed. Same with Davis. It's just
in Robinson, the Federal Circuit explicitly said that the board looked at everything. Here they say the board didn't look at something. Isn't that a huge distinction? I mean, here they're saying the board failed to do something they should have done.
No, I think this goes back to our primary point here. I don't see that as being a huge distinction because the discussion is not geared toward the merits of the underlying service connection claim, nor would the Federal Circuit have the authority to reach that issue. They have limited appellate jurisdiction over decisions from this court. They can review legal questions. In fact, in the Federal Circuit's decision, it states at the toward the beginning that Federal Circuit's reviewing whether the Veterans Court exceeded its jurisdiction, which is a question of law. So they're not reaching the merits of the underlying decision. They're highlighting what is not resolved. And if you don't highlight that, how can the Federal Circuit state, well, this court resolved an issue that it was open to debate? It's so just...
If instance, and there was administrative error, and then there was everything else. It looks here like there's administrative error and then there's this open to debate zone that could be implicit error or not. And yeah, no, it's on Judge Balbi that this the Federal Circuit is saying the Veterans Court erred because this falls within that open to debate zone. And, you know, the development, whatever it is, would have to kind of happen within that zone. I guess stated differently, the question, where would the Federal Circuit get jurisdiction to assess the adequacy of a medical exam?
So I don't think that it could. And I think that that's why they didn't reach that issue. It's only highlighting what how this court misstepped in resolving issues of fact in weighing evidence. I don't think that the court could reach that question. I think where maybe you get into a different area is where the Federal Circuit finds that this court erred by not identifying something that's clear error. I think we tried to illustrate that point in our briefing with the issue in Lange. But here, there's no such finding. The Federal Circuit isn't reaching to that next level to say that this court erred by not finding error. It's saying that this court erred by resolving facts that were open to debate, facts that were based on an argument presented for the first time on appeal. And we know from binding case law that we're in that area with newly raised arguments and discretionary remands, those do not generally confer prevailing party status. We're clearly in that wheelhouse here. It's a discretionary remand based on a newly raised argument. I think we all recognize that this was a new issue raised for the first time on appeal. Because
the point that if examiners and competent medical professionals had that commented on the pre, the insertions incidents, that then they would not have been open to debate. Is that the point that because they didn't comment on this, they were there? And therefore, our court should not have considered, we shouldn't have resolved that issue.
I think perhaps, I think if the examiners, if two things were true. First, if this argument had been presented to the agency in the first place. And second, if the medical examiners had, resolved the issue of the location of the in-service rash vis-a-vis the 2011 lesion that supports the later diagnosis, then I think that in that context, at least, it wouldn't be matters that are open to debate because there'd be clear medical evidence resolving it. But that necessary component there still is that the issue was not raised before. It's a new argument presented for the first time on appeal. And the Federal Circuit is saying, if that's the case, you can resolve it if the facts are not open to debate. But if they are open and we're in the discretionary remand sort of wheelhouse, then the appropriate course, I think the Federal Circuit stated this explicitly, thus in considering a newly raised argument on appeal, the Veterans Court should appropriately review the record and remand to appropriate body any factual questions open to debate, citing to Majid that discretionary authority with issue exhaustion. When it's a new issue raised for the first time on appeal, that is the appropriate course of action. But that's sort of like the merits of the case. In the aegis phase, which is where we're at now, the precedent is clear that sort of discretionary remand, which is definitely what we're in here, does not confer prevailing party status. Unless if implicit agency error can be gleaned from that decision, which we maintain cannot be gleaned here, then there is no prevailing party status.
I'm good.
Judge Greenberg, do you have any questions?
I had a question, but it has been resolved based upon the subsequent argument. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Nothing further.
Thank you, Greenberg. Counsel, anything further?
Nothing further, Your Honor.
So I have three notes. The first is that there was no discretion in the decision about, in the Federal Circuit's decision, about whether the VA had to develop the record. And it reflects that in this court's remand. The second thing that I just want to note is that discussion of Majid. I think my friend's argument would be more forceful if this weren't a precedential decision. And what I think the court was doing is there had been a number of fact-finding cases that have come up recently. And I think what it was doing was simply issuing guidance to this court saying, hey, in the future, you don't have to entertain these issues if you don't want to. And so we don't have to get to the fact-finding
part of it. And so I think that that's all the court was doing, was it was looking to prospective courts and just saying, hey, you don't have to entertain these issues if you don't want to, but if you, they need to be done through the process that, that the statutes reflect. And then lastly, just on the Rule 39, whether the court rules on this as a...
Well, you got to be honest.
Oh, sure.
I think that's a fair reading fact. But this is a not substantial part of our case law are basically failure to address case. And I mean, I don't, it would be difficult if this case basically stands for the position that those cases can now all be issued exhausted or now discretionary for courts to review. You know, I mean, ultimately, like we have to either remand them or do something.
I mean,
here we're in the aegis, so we're dealing with the context of administrative error. But I guess I'm going to keep returning to this question. Administrative error presupposes a jurisdiction to review error. I mean, that's exactly what jurisdiction is. And once taken away, I don't see how we can make a finding of administrative error without jurisdiction to assess error. Like I got to kind of keep in this recursive loop to how we can resolve this for EJIA purposes.
I think that it's easy to fall into an either or here, and I think it's an either or. I think it's a both and. I think that there was a judicial error, and I think that there was an administrative error. And because the court talks about it and imposed a duty on the VA, I think that that gives you.
Where does the Federal Circuit jurisdiction look into? Idea of medical exam. I mean, what would be
a case like constitutional issue? It can analyze facts. It could look if there was a constitutional issue that was connected to the exam. I think that it would.
I mean, it's a specific finding. I mean, they're chiding us for inability to facts. How would they make an implicit finding of error without some assessment of the merits of the medical exam? You know, or just the duty to assess whether that was satisfied.
Well, I don't want to get in between this court and the Federal Circuit, but I would say that the court is looking at the case before it. It's not looking to administrative error necessarily. So sometimes you have to. That's why the implicit administrative error rule exists. It's because it has to be limited to the matters before it, and it's not supposed to go outside what's necessary to decide the case.
Since it's, you know, it's for better, I mean, anybody who raises these issues in a remand, I just don't see how EJIA, I mean, unfortunately, it may be difficult to get EJIA fees on it, but I just don't see how we can make a finding of administrative error when we lack capacity to adjudicate something.
I think that the jurisdiction is, I think it's more, I don't think that the jurisdictional prohibition is as broad. I think that what the prohibition is simply, if they haven't made a finding of fact on a narrow issue, then you have to send it back, but you can't make a finding on that same issue because there's not a predicate finding in order to rule. So I don't think it's such a broad issue. I think you have other ways to declare what the law is, and I don't think that it's that. Well, I don't think it's such a broad curtailing of this court's jurisdiction. I think, and I think that it can still, the Federal Circuit can still speak to administrative error in this context, and I think that it's important. I think that the Federal Circuit is going to want to. We were talking about moral hazard earlier. The Federal Circuit would not want to create a moral hazard in not giving fees to a prevailing party like a veteran or their counsel, because it would encourage, we would no longer bring these cases to the Federal Circuit, and then the court would be more inclined to exceed its jurisdiction, and the Federal Circuit is not going to want that. So there's a moral hazard there, too, that I think that the court should consider.
Counsel, this is Judge Greenberg. Can you hear me?
Judge Greenberg, we're struggling to hear you.
Can you hear me now?
A little better.
I'm struggling.
I'm struggling.
I think I can hear you. I'll repeat the question.
Can you hear me now?
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you enough. Try
all right, I'll try to make my question. What is the holding? What is the precise holding you would like the court to enter in your case?
So Judge Greenberg asked you, what is the precise holding?
So the holding is that the Federal Circuit, Mr. Simpson prevailed because the Federal Circuit materially altered the plaintiff's legal relationship by imposing a duty to assist on reimposing the duty to assist on the secretary for Mr. Simpson's benefit, and that duty to assist points back to an administrative error that supports the that supports his prevailing party status.
Thank you.
If this had been just a garden variety, reasonably raised, a question of whether an issue is reasonably raised and undressed by the board, so we don't get into the exercise of our discretion or anything like that. It's just, and when we ended it, you're a prevailing party, right?
No, we would not be. If you just remand it with no guarantees whatsoever.
I think you're misunderstanding me. So if you've got a situation where the issue had been easily raised,
okay,
to the board,
okay,
addressed, it comes up here, you argue they didn't address this issue, make no findings of fact, we don't exercise discretion, we don't get into whether or not we're going to issue exhaustion or anything like that. And we therefore need to remand it to fix that administrative error.
I understand now.
And it's EJIA, right?
We get EJIA because the duty was that it was a reasonably raised issue that the board didn't discuss. And then if you were to send it back and say you have to discuss this now, there's the duty that's being imposed that materially alters the relationship, then you would get EJIA because the relationship has been materially altered. It benefits the defendant.
See, I'm a pretty simple guy, so I like to simplify things. And it strikes me that that's what you've got here when you remove all the chaff that's in the vicinity. Is that you've got the question of impermissible fact finding and all that. There was favorable evidence in the record that went unaddressed. The Federal Circuit noted that and said, and when we remand it, take a look at that.
And that's the discussion we had in the oral argument with the Federal Circuit. It was centered on this piece.
Any further, counsel?
Nothing further. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you to both of you. Thank you. This matter is taken under advisement.
All rise.